Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'm Philip Ernest Anselmo, the appellant. And I come here today to ask you to exercise power and transform it into justice. And before I begin, is there any questions you have?
I'll jump in. So with that, I can't not take that invitation. I guess, obviously, we're looking at an appeal from a preliminary injunction. One of the concerns or issues I have about where we are here is, what exactly is the status quo? Both sides seem to be disagreeing on what the status quo is that we have to deal with for purposes of this appeal. So I'd be interested in your view on what is the status quo. Does it include keeping all the properties in place, or do we measure it by looking at what the complaint is about, and is it relating just to the management, or is it something different?
The status quo of this case, all across the country and in Colorado, is the last peaceable moment between the parties before the dispute arises. And for what we know is that for the previous 12 years, there was never a dispute. Mr. Anselmo was always the manager. Mr. Anselmo was the only one who voted. Mr. Anselmo managed all of the properties. And we also know that the plaintiffs admitted they don't even know where the properties are. They not only did not ever exercise a vote, but they never even tried to. So the status quo changed dramatically when the plaintiffs said, "We're in charge now," and threw out the existing manager. So when the trial court completed
that was in place before we had this lawsuit, right? I mean, from the plaintiff's position, they have replaced you as the manager, and they say you're interfering. This is their allegation, and what they're seeking in this court is a declaration that you're not the manager and don't have authority, and a preliminary injunction that says Mr. Anselmo needs to stop. So isn't the status quo that they are the managers, and that needs and their authority needs to be protected while this case proceeds?
It's a good question, but the courts decided a long time ago that the status quo is the last peaceable moment. And up until the PI issued, there was a lot of argument during that month or two when the plaintiffs said we're in charge.
Mr. Anselmo, excuse me for interrupting you. Is there a court decision that you're relying on for your statement that the status quo is measured as of the last peaceable moment between the parties?
Yeah, there's several. The one, the Greyhound case and the Simpson case in Colorado. I have a quote that from our neighboring court, too, that I liked a lot, so I brought that with us. That's from a Texas court, Supreme Court case. It's called State versus Southwest Bell at 526 Southwest 2nd 528 from 1975. And the reason I like that quote is because it's very succinct. It says, "The status quo has long been defined as the last actual peaceable, non-contested status which preceded the pending controversy." And in our briefs, we also cite the Colorado case that says the same thing, but it took two paragraphs. Anything else, Justice Gabriel?
I guess I'm still not sure if we're... So what? Maybe I should ask this way. What is subsumed within this last peaceable moment from your view? Is it that you're still the manager? And I don't mean disrespect. It seems a little awkward to call you and to use a third person when you're standing in front of me, so I mean no disrespect. Does it mean that you're still the manager and all the properties are in place or something different? I'm having trouble understanding what your position is as to the last peaceable moment. What's included in that?
Well, the last peaceable moment had all properties in place, 91 parcels of property worth $50 million, managed for 12 years by one person. Nobody else ever voted that was ever in this LLC. And that last peaceable moment was in 2010, when it was contested that the plaintiffs weren't even members of the LLC. They were in one other LLC with Mr. Anselmo, the same two people. And they retired at the end of 2009 from that one. And they said, when they retired, they said, "We'd never retire from this unless we had a written memorialization." If you look at Exhibit 6, that argument that they made was completely refuted by the fact that when they withdrew from that LLC, that there was no written memorialization. But we have 12 years of prior history, never voting, never managing, never seeing the properties, never contributing a penny. That's the status quo.
You disagree I take it you have this theory, which I was going to ask you about capital ownership versus other ownership. Let's, before we get there, though, assuming that that we will follow the Colorado statute that says a member of the LLC or the majority members get to fire the manager, whatever it says, would you disagree that the plaintiffs here are even the members of the LLC?
You're asking if I agree or disagree if they're
right. You keep saying you have referred to now a number of times that they had no say in it. You just alluded to that at some point they were not members in the LLC.
Right.
I mean, it seemed to me they have 95%. They're 95% members of the LLC. And I guess my question simply is: are you disputing that? And what's the basis for your dispute?
We are disputing that, Your Honor, for several reasons. The first one is there's not even members in that year. And the evidence that supports that the trial judge didn't even look at, he didn't say I agree or disagree, he didn't even look at it, was they withdrew from the only other LLC for business purposes because they retired. They said, we don't need these anymore.
So let me understand. In evidence, there's two LLCs?
Right.
And one is the Westridge Group?
Correct.
And the other is what?
West Elk Ranch.
West Elk Ranch. And which one was formed first?
The Westridge Group was formed first.
And it was formed with all three members, all three parties as members?
No, it was formed solely by Mr. Anselmo in 1998.
As the only member?
Right.
And then West Elk, when was that formed?
2000.
And that was formed with three members?
That was formed solely with Mr. Anselmo. And then pretty quickly afterwards, Mr. Sisler, who was a witness in the hearing, joined that LLC too. He was a member of both of those in 2000.
And at what point did Mr. Jacobson and Patricia Anselmo become members of either of these?
They became members in 2000 as well. Okay. But Mrs. Anselmo never became a member. Only Mr. Jacobson did.
Of both LLCs?
Right.
And so what was Mr. Jacobson's interest in West Ridge as of the time? The time where they claim they voted you out as the manager.
Well, I'm glad you asked that, Judge Gabriel, because the question that the trial court had that he messed up on, the trial court judge says, I don't understand the difference between governance rights, ownership rights, and operating interests, because I don't understand it. And what's more, even if I understood it, I don't even agree that's the law. That's what he said before he made his ruling, which shows that the merits of this case is completely skewed because the judge misapprehended the law. Mr. Jacobson had only an interest of operating, no governance rights, and no ownership rights. This federal statute, they call it 0.7, but it's 1.704 of the Internal Revenue Regulations, states that capital interests determine what your ownership interest is.
Doesn't that have to do with partnerships? What does that have to do with an LLC?
Well, LLCs in Colorado and all across America can only be taxed in two ways. One of the ways that you can elect to be taxed is a partnership. If you make that election, just like when you sign up to be an LLC in Colorado, you also make an election if you're member-managed or manager-managed. They call that the check-the-box election. If you elect to be taxed as a partnership, that partnership law governs the interaction and the rights of the parties.
Can you cite me anything in Colorado state law, or statute, case law, or anything else that makes the same distinction among LLCs?
Unfortunately, because the LLC law has only been around for 20 years, started in Wyoming, there's no case law that addresses it. And also the statute that Colorado used isn't that clear. It was supposed to be patterned on the uniform law, the uniform LLC law, but there's a lot of parts that are ambiguous. And because it's so new in the time of law, there's not much precedent about it. But Mr. Jacobson admitted that his interests were operating interests. He admitted that. That's not a disputed fact. He admitted that he never put one piece of property into the LLC, not one. He admitted that he made no capital contributions at all. He said, yeah, I guaranteed some loans. That's it. He used this solely as a vehicle to take tax deductions. His tax deductions exceeded the amount of his contribution to the LLC. And so he's a debtor of the LLC. Trial court misapprehending the fact that the interests of an LLC have governance rights, and you can have, and they often do, LLCs have people run them, that don't have any ownership interest. But it's really, you have to be really careful not to act adverse to the interests of the LLC, just like in a corporation. The shareholders have an interest, but the trial judge thought shareholder interests in a corporation are identical to an LLC, and they're not. And that was the problem the trial judge had. So he misapplied the law by not understanding that there's this difference. And it's true that in 2005, Mr. Jacobson did have a 95% interest in the LLC's operating interests because he wanted the losses for his taxes. And he filed joint returns.
Sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Anselmo. How did he come about this interest that you're talking about? Let's take for a minute that there is such a thing as an operating interest. How did he gain this interest in the LLC?
Every year there was an agreement. In some years, Mr. Anselmo had 95%. It was based essentially upon what do you think next year is going to result in your tax liability? How much of this operating loss do you need? Because there's a lot of depreciation interest expense.
And when did this 95% operating interest end, in your view?
At the end of 2009, the beginning of 2010.
What was the evidence supporting that Mr. Jacobson's 95% interest ended at that time?
Because it's a family, as you know, the record doesn't have a lot of writings. And because it's a family, the changes each year are only substantiated after the fact. If you look at the K-1s, you'll see what those interests were. We provided the K-1 for the most recent year that said in 2009 he had the 95% operating interest, 0% capital interest.
So if the court did not agree with you that there's a distinction between operating versus managing interest, the court had some evidence that Mr. Jacobson had 95%. Right. Based on your own K-1.
Some courts could perhaps say that there's congruent interests, but that's belied by the fact that the K-1 doesn't show any interest in capital, but more importantly, by the trial judge saying, I don't understand that there's a distinction. He said that. He says, I don't see there's any difference.
Well, what do you do about 780-402, CRS 7-80-402? Managers may be designated and removed by the consent of a majority of the members. There's nothing in that statute that says there's a difference between operating membership versus capital membership versus anything else. It just talks about members. Sure. How do you get around that?
Well, you don't have to get around it. I think the statute's poorly drafted because what that does is it ignores the fact that a manager that has an interest can do things that are against the LLC's interests. So I think it's poorly drafted in that regard. But if you accept it, and just say, you know, we're not the legislature, that's the rules, we have to stick with it, that's fine. The problem is that the way they got into a governance position was by error. The error being that even if they had any interest at all, it was only Mr. Jacobson. He didn't present any evidence in 2009 of what his interest was. In 2010, it's zero. But in 2009, it's just two people, Mr. Jacobson, Mr. Anselmo. So he can't vote himself in. Secondly, even if you accept the fact, or the claim fact, that Mr. Jacobson says, suddenly I'm in charge, he's not allowed to loot the LLC. He's not allowed to liquidate under the statute, 780 as well. It says you can't liquidate absent unanimity of everybody. Everybody has to agree. Unless you do that, you can't liquidate. But when he took over, the trial judge says, I understand you're going to be liquidating. And he goes, yeah, that's our goal. You can't do that. So there's a lot of errors here, and we haven't even got to the other five Rathke factors. We're still on status quo, but I've only got a minute left, so I'd like to reserve a little bit of time.
Of course. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Eric?
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Joe Bernstein.
Sorry, Mr. Bernstein.
I'm sorry.
I called you Mr. Merrick. I don't remember what Mr. Merrick looks like. I haven't seen him in a long time.
Well, actually, I am Joe Bernstein. I represent the appellees, Westbridge Group, LLC. Dennis Jacobson and Patricia Anselmo. I want to first apologize for my attire. Mr. Merrick was supposed to argue today's oral argument this afternoon. He informed me that he is very, very ill and asked me to appear here for him. He did that on short notice, and I have disregarded his advice to always keep a tie in my office.
Thank you for your courtesy in that, sir.
I do apologize for that. The record below is that the trial court, Montrose County, properly considered all of the Rathke factors in entering preliminary injunction in favor of the plaintiffs. The evidence is simply uncontroverted that in early 2010, the plaintiffs, Dennis Jacobson and Patricia Anselmo, jointly owned together 95% of this company.
Now, what is that? Obviously, Mr. Anselmo disagrees with you. Putting aside the difference between operating and managing, what's the evidence that you rely on for the statement that you just made?
The evidence is there's several documents that prove that fact. The first is Schedule K-1s that were delivered to the plaintiffs by Mr. Anselmo year after year, which all evidence a 95% ownership interest by the plaintiffs. There are also correspondence with third-party lenders where Mr. Anselmo seeks financing from lenders and represents to those third-party lenders that the ownership of the company is as follows. Philip Anselmo, 5%, Dennis Jacobson, 47.5, Patricia Anselmo, 47.5.
This is all in evidence in the trial court?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. Yes. All of that documentary evidence was presented to Judge Shum in the district court. Judge Shum reviewed the evidence and considered the argument of Mr. Anselmo, which is Mr. Anselmo's argument on the ownership issue essentially is, well, in 2009, Dennis Jacobson and Patricia Anselmo disclaimed any ownership interest they had in the company. They disclaimed it. Now, there's no documentary evidence of that whatsoever. Mr. Anselmo did not present any documentation of that fact to Judge Shum in Montrose County, none whatsoever. Also, in order to accept that argument, one would have to believe that the plaintiffs were willing to give up a 95% ownership interest in the company in exchange for no consideration whatsoever. It just doesn't, it's not even logically plausible, aside from being unsupported by any evidence whatsoever. The plaintiffs have presented documentation, proof, evidence, written evidence, that was in fact authored and executed by Mr. Anselmo, showing that the plaintiffs have a 95% ownership interest in this company in May of 2010.
Mr. Weinstein, can I ask you, the same question I asked Mr. Anselmo, could you address what is your understanding of the status quo in this case for purposes of the application of the Rathke factors?
Yes, Judge. The status quo is that in May of 2010, the plaintiffs were 95% owners of this company. They had a 95%, the overwhelming majority of this company is owned by plaintiffs. In April of 2010, the plaintiffs caused Mr. Anselmo to be removed as the manager. They executed a letter and sent it off to Mr. Anselmo and exercised their rights under 7-80-402 to remove him as the manager of the company. So the status quo here is the plaintiffs own 95% of the company. Litigation is being commenced against the company. Mr. Anselmo, as manager, is refusing to do anything about that litigation. And the 95% owners of the company have properly exercised their rights under Colorado law to remove Mr. Anselmo as manager and have appointed themselves as co-manager. That's the status quo. That's what we have heading in.
What do we do? I interrupted you twice. I apologize. What do we do about the properties? I mean, and I guess I have two related questions, and then I'll shut up and let you speak. Do we not factor in all these properties that are, I guess, being either deeds in lieu or some such or foreclosed on by stipulation? Do we not consider those, the properties, as part of the status quo here? And would you also address, in connection with your answer, Mr. Anselmo's point that your clients as 95% owners don't have the right to liquidate all the assets of the company without his permission?
Let me, if I might, let me address those in the reverse order.
Of course.
And first, let me point out that the current owners of the company and current managers of the company, Dennis Jacobson and Patricia Anselmo, are not liquidating the company. There's been a repeated argument by Mr. Anselmo, both before this court and before the trial court, that the appellees here are liquidating all of the assets of the company. The appellees are, in fact, not doing that. The company still owns significant real estate assets down in Montrose and Delta counties. Some of those properties have been sold in order to avoid significant foreclosure actions and other litigation. But there is no liquidation. That liquidation is just simply not occurring. So that's sort of the first point.
Oh, it's just settling lawsuits here.
Settling lawsuits and trying to avoid catastrophic financial damage to the company and its owners. That's what's happening. But in terms of an organized liquidation, simply a garage sale of the properties or something to that effect, is just simply not happening and not supported by the record. Moreover, Mr. Anselmo, during his argument to this court, he had represented to this court that at the preliminary injunction hearing, that Mr. Jacobson had testified that his intent was in fact to liquidate the company. That's actually not that, that Mr. Jacobson did not in fact ever make any such representation to the district court, nor is any liquidation happening. Getting back to your first question, Your Honor, regarding the properties, what do we do about the properties? The status quo really is that the company owns the properties and that the company is responsible for managing the properties. There is no alteration of the status quo by entry of this injunction with respect to the ownership of those properties or the right to manage those properties. Prior to the injunction, the properties are all owned by Westridge Group, and Westridge Group manages those properties. After entry of the injunction, Westridge Group is still the owner and manager of those properties.
Mr. Bernstein, what's your response to Mr. Anselmo's contention that we measure the status quo from the last peaceable status of the parties, which would have been before Mr. Jacobson and Ms. Anselmo became managers of the LLC?
First, I'm not aware of any authority in Colorado to that effect. I scribbled down Mr. Anselmo's citations to this court when this court asked him for that authority. Those authorities are not in Mr. Anselmo's opening brief.
They are in his brief.
Simpson and Greyhound are both in the brief.
Simpson and Greyhound are cited in the brief. I'm not aware that Simpson and Greyhound say what Mr. Anselmo says, reports that they say. But assuming that the last peaceable moment is the correct measure of the status quo, I would argue that the last peaceable moment here is subsequent to Mr. Jacobson's and Patricia Anselmo's removal of Philip Anselmo as manager of the company. Mr. Jacobson and Ms. Anselmo removed Mr. Anselmo as manager of the company peaceably and exercised their rights under Colorado's LLC statute. I think the last peaceable moment here is immediately prior to the filing of the complaint and the motion for preliminary injunction. Obviously, Mr. Anselmo disagrees with his removal. Obviously, Mr. Anselmo believes that his removal shouldn't have occurred, and that the plaintiffs didn't have the authority to do that. Now, regardless whether that's right or wrong, the last peaceable moment here is immediately prior to the motion for preliminary injunction, when the owners, the 95% owners of the company, have peaceably exercised their rights under the statute to remove Mr. Anselmo as manager.
Ask you to address a different issue on the Rathke factors, Mr. Bernstein, and that's the question of whether there's an adequate remedy at law. And I'd be very interested in your addressing the argument that you make. It sounded to me like a large part of your argument was that essentially Mr. Anselmo would be judgment-proof. I may be overstating that or misreading it. I'd be concerned if that's your argument, though, being very candid, that you can make that argument in many, many preliminary injunction cases. Gee, the defendant is judgment proof, so you know we need an injunction. So could you address, you know, why is there not an adequate remedy at law here?
Well, the only adequate remedy at law in the absence of the injunction, let's hypothesize that the injunction doesn't get entered. And let's hypothesize that Mr. Anselmo continues to pilot the company on a financial course that results in ruin to the company. The 95% owners of the company are personal guarantors on most of the loans that have been taken out by Westridge Group. Those third-party lenders are going to pursue the plaintiffs in this case. Their only adequate remedy here, their only remedy at all, would be to proceed in the litigation and try to seek damages from Mr. Anselmo. Mr. Anselmo has represented to the district court and to Judge Shum in Montrose County that he is indigent. He has filed a certificate stating that he has no income, and he's asked for a court-appointed attorney to be appointed for him. Mr. Anselmo is, in essence, judgment-proof by his own admission. If the preliminary injunction is not entered here, and those third-party lenders proceed against the plaintiffs personally, the plaintiffs will have no choice except to perhaps file bankruptcy or try to defend those lawsuits in some way, shape, or form. At the conclusion of all of that litigation, the plaintiffs would be wiped out financially, and their only recourse, if we want to call it that, is to proceed in a case for damages against the man who claims that he has no resources to satisfy any such judgment. So the only remedy here would be to proceed in litigation. At the end of the day, if the plaintiffs were to obtain a judgment in that litigation, that judgment would barely be worth the paper it's printed on.
So, and I guess my concern is where we draw the line on such a rule. My fear, frankly, would be in just about any case where there's some preliminary injunction, somebody would say, yeah, I mean, I know I could sue him, you know, at the end of the day, but he doesn't have any money. And I'm troubled that that would be the standard for an adequate remedy at law. And it sounds like what you're telling me is the rule. I mean, there's no question your clients would have a claim for damages against Mr. Anselmo, whether they could collect or not. They'd be in the same boat as many plaintiffs in society. They have a great claim and no way to collect it. Is there some case law that would suggest that if the defendant is insolvent or couldn't pay the money judgment that you would have, that gets you an inadequate remedy at law? You cited, I think, Gitlitz for that proposition, but I'm not sure that gets you there.
Yes.
But I'm willing to hear your argument to the contrary.
Well, the Gitlitz case does stand for the proposition that irreparable harm that term needs to be applied on a case-by-case basis. There is no universal definition of irreparable harm. We need to look on a case-by-case basis at what exactly is the harm that the moving party is going to sustain in the absence of the preliminary injunction. And I think this case presents a bit of a unique circumstance insofar as here we have litigation that against the plaintiffs from third parties that has not only been threatened, it actually commenced. So we have actual financial harm that will result to the plaintiffs. There's no question about that. We have lawsuits and litigation commenced against the plaintiffs. It's also unique in the sense that here we have a defendant who has voluntarily come before the court and has said, I am indigent. There's no question about my indigency. Here's an affidavit proving my indigency. And so we have a unique set of circumstances here where the catastrophic financial harm suffered by the plaintiffs in the absence of a preliminary injunction is undisputed. And the inability of a defendant to satisfy any judgment whatsoever entered against him in the litigation is undisputed. That's fairly rare. I understand the court's concern that if we define irreparable injury as just simply, well, I can't collect on a judgment against him, that is a slippery slope. And I understand the court's concern about that. I truly do. I think this is a unique case where here we have catastrophic financial injury to the plaintiffs, undisputed. Inability of defendant to satisfy a judgment against him in any amount, also undisputed. So I'm not quite so concerned about the slippery slope because of the unique circumstances of the case. Addressing briefly the capital accounts issue, Mr. Anselmo has argued at length that the ability to manage, the ability to control the direction of an LLC should be determined not by one's membership interest on paper, but by one's capital account ownership interest. First of all, there's no case law on that point that Mr. Anselmo has provided, none whatsoever. Second, it is contrary to the Colorado statute 7-80-402, as the court observed during Mr. Anselmo's argument. And third, the tax regulation, as the court also observed, that Mr. Anselmo has cited frequently in his opening brief and in his reply brief, doesn't apply to LLCs. It has to do with partnerships, and not just partnerships, but it specifically, that portion of the tax code applies specifically to the liquidation of a partnership. Doesn't apply to LLCs and doesn't apply to liquidation of LLCs either. And even if it did, it certainly wouldn't trump Colorado statutory law to the contrary. I'm out of time, so unless there are any further questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Bernstein. Before I forget to ask, Mr. Bernstein, I know you got called on no notice, and we appreciate your efforts in that regard. I'm not sure if you've done this yet, but just for the court's record, we would appreciate your filing an entry of appearance, just a formal entry, so we know who you are and where you are, if you would do that.
I will do so. Thank you, Your
Thank
Honor.
You. Mr. Anselmo, you've got a minute, 29 seconds left.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll start with the adequate remedies. Up until the time that this PI was issued, 100% of $50 million company was owned 100% by Mr. Anselmo. He put in every single asset, 91 parcels of property. He put in over $3 million of operating capital for that company. Mr. Jacobson contributed nothing. The trial judge took all of those assets, his cars, his homes, everything he built up his whole life, and just gave it to the plaintiffs. That's why he became indigent. And as adequate remedy, Mr. Jacobson didn't prove any of it. He just said, I might get kicked off a couple boards and lose some income. That's monetary damages. You don't get a PI for monetary damages. And I'm very sensitive to the court's ruling. You do have to draw a line. If somebody says, I've got a good case and they'll claim, that doesn't give you a PI. As to the evidence that Mr. Bernstein claims is in the record, there's absolutely no K-1s in the record. He just said they're there for 10 years. They're not in the record. The only K-1s in the record are those from 2009. They're at CR 307 and CR 126. As to a statement that Mr. Anselmo repeatedly told the lenders, plural, that they're 95% owners, there's only a few lenders, but none of those lenders were ever told that except one lender on one loan 5 years before this case took place. And in that, the exhibit, they only introduced two pieces of paper. And one of them says Mr. Anselmo is the only manager, he's the only one entitled to get a loan, and he's the one who's in charge of the LLC. And the other one, it doesn't clarify what the 95% ownership interest is, but the K-1 that I just alluded to does. It says operating interest only.
Your time's up, Mr. Anselmo.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Anselmo and Mr. Bernstein. We thank you both for your briefs and arguments in this case. The case will stand submitted, and the opinion will issue in due course.